The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We want this morning to begin moving ahead now, looking at the second and main and last major portion of our study on this canon question, the area of theological reflection. And what I want to do first of all in a section 10, as you'll see, is to proceed to a statement of the problem. A statement of the problem, which I will try to get at from a couple of angles so that there is a common mindset among us, and then we'll move ahead, as you see, working toward a solution to put things, a hopeful perspective on things. Let me say, by the way, that with reference to the material we're about to get into here, that the material, especially in sections 3 and 4, that is, on the Church's idea of the canon that we discussed, this under the introduction head, and then the presuppositions for our study of canon are to be brought into the picture here especially. Now, our concern at this point is to be with the traditional or church's idea of the canon, as that conception has emerged in the life of the early church, in the history that we have been looking at all along, and as that view of canon has then found classic expression, classic confession, for one place in the Westminster Confession of Faith. Modifying that conception now to fit the concerns or to fit the situation with reference to the New Testament specifically, we can say, remind ourselves here again, that our concern now is to be with the New Testament as canon, and as that involves then the notion that the New Testament as canon is that collection of 27 books, commonly called the New Testament, that collection of 27 books, which as closed collection or completed unit, collection of 27 books, which as closed collection and completed unit, and by virtue of the divine, of its divine origin, better the divine origin of each book, possesses final authority in matters of faith and life. Now that is the conception of canon which is now on the line, which we want to proceed to reflect on. Now the statement as I just gave it, this working definition, it contains three essential elements. There is the idea of a closed collection, a completed unit, closed collection. Then there is the notion of the divine origin or the inspiration of the documents. And then the issue of authority. Now, of these three notions, only the first is properly problematic at this point. That is, only the notion of closed collection is what we are seeking to make problematic at this point, brought up for discussion. And again, this is because the limits of our work here do not allow us otherwise. The fact of the divine origin, the inspiration of each of the writings, and therefore all of them, that is to be a necessary assumption here. It's certainly not irrelevant, but it's the consideration that we have to assume, the reality of inspired scripture, God-breathed documents. And the authority of the New Testament deserves mention here only to the extent that it's necessary for us to remind ourselves, always keep in view, that the notion of authority, the notion of authority is given with the idea of canon. So what we're wanting to say here now is that the real problem of the New Testament as canon is the closed or completed character of the New Testament. The closed or completed character of the New Testament. The issue then, we could proceed as a stimulus to discussion. The issue then could be put in the way of a question or a set of questions. Why does the church accept this concrete collection? Why accept just these 27 books and no others? How do we know, putting a question again, how do we know that there is not some document no longer extant which may someday be discovered and consequently then deserve to be included in the New Testament? This way of putting it, kind of a perennial question in this area of canon. How do we know that there is not some document which may one day be discovered and then ought to be included? Or, also looking at the other way, how do we know that there is something, how do we know whether there's something that has slipped into the canon which really doesn't belong? As some, particularly not especially out of a strong view of canon, but as a number of critical contemporary critical scholars are concerned, especially to see 2 Peter eliminated from the other literature of the New Testament. Now, these questions can take on a particularly pressing character, and perhaps even for some of us a distressing character, when we pose them now in the light of the historical survey in which we have been involved. We have seen that it is a slow process, roughly 300 years, a process of 300 years before the canon accepted in the church is the same as ours. And as we have noted, there are significant differences of opinion, even between Orthodox men at earlier stages. It was, as we were noting yesterday, 367 before we have the first official ecclesiastical decision to the effect of the 27-book canon. This slow progress, slow process. whereas it was put to me one time in a less elegant way, 300 years before the cork is in the bottle. Again, why did the shepherd, which has some definite, rather strong support at first, why does that eventually go by the board? Whereas 2 Peter, which at least as far as we're able to tell, has rather weak support, eventually come to find a place. The question all told then can be put this way. Something of a bottom line, cutting edge. How do we know that in accepting the New Testament, which we have today, and remember then the authority which goes with it, how do we know that in accepting this New Testament, we are not simply following the decision of men, the decision of men who, to be sure, were well-intentioned, but who were nonetheless fallible men like ourselves? How do we know that the canon is not a matter of fallible judgment? Or as I saw it recently in a bumper sticker, as I guess it's Thomas Edison supposed to have said, that all Bibles are created by man. Now, that's the issue before us. And I hope then that I've formulated the problem and touched at the aspects in ways that which touch on where you are and where you have concerns at this point. So that is the problem, and brings us a position where we want then to move ahead, and in this 11th section, where we'll be occupied, you can see, for the rest of our session, work toward a solution. But now, very unsmoothly, I just remembered that I didn't quite round off section 9 under the historical survey at the end of the hour yesterday. So will you bear with me and just back up? I take it this question is formulated won't fly away from your minds, and let's just touch quickly on a final point I really should make for the sake of completeness on that historical survey. We were looking, this is under 9, in the period 220 to 400. We had looked at, you remember, at Origen, at Eusebius, at Athanasius, and the significance of Athanasius in affirming the 27-book canon for the first time. And then in the fourth place here, I just want to mention quickly what we can put under the category now, not of a person, but the activity or the decisions of church councils, the decision of councils, which take place near the end of the fourth century. Athanasius' Easter letter, we can say, almost immediately takes on a kind of decretal force. It's an ecclesiastically, it becomes a more or less, functions as a more or less formal ecclesiastical decision within the Greek-speaking church. And another figure in this context we can mention is Epiphanius, who affirms the 27-book canon around 403. For the East, then, the situation is firmed through Athanasius' work, basically. In the West, for the Latin-speaking church, the Senate of Rome in 382 declares the 27 books and they alone as canonical. So you see, this follows within a little more than a decade of about 15 years after Athanasius' Easter letter. For the African church, Latin speaking in North Africa, the Synod of Hippo in 393, and then Carthage in 397, adopt, in effect, the 382 canon of Rome. And so we simply wanted to say, finally, that from this point on, the New Testament in the church is a matter of what is officially fixed or defined, and we can say universally accepted. There are, of course, random exceptions to that generalization about universal acceptance. There are remnants of the differences that we have seen in the earlier period that do continue from place to place in the East and especially in the Syrian church. But we can say then that the matter of the New Testament canon is a matter of virtually universal consensus really until the 18th century, until the time of the Enlightenment when the whole idea of canon on Enlightenment philosophical grounds, on the basis of the principle of the autonomy of the critical historian, the canon idea then is called into question. The next conciliar statement on the contents of Scripture, on the contents of canon, appears to be at Trent. The Council, the Roman Catholic Council of the Counter-Reformation in 1546. Not that there aren't canon lists, many canon lists in between, but a conciliar declaration is not seen as necessary, really, until nearly a millennium later. So now that rounds off our historical survey. Yes. You're talking now about Old Testament Apocrypha. I haven't brought those into our discussion here because Dr. Dillard in the Old Testament Introduction course will pick that up. But I think it's fair to say that it's really not until Trent that they are affirmed over against the Reformation. That is a somewhat misleading way of putting it because you can say the whole medieval period is sort of one in which, at least officially, there's ambivalence on the question of the Old Testament Apocrypha. And there is a tradition of maintaining them, and it's that tradition which then is formally decreed by Trent. Just how dominant that is another question that I'm not in a position to comment on. All right, now we can skip from 9 to 11, having already been at 10. And let me emphasize now how important, in my judgment, is the reading material that I've asked you to do, especially the elements in the assignments in Stonehouse and Ritterboss. And what I see myself to be doing here is simply commenting on the position they have taken, expanding on it, elaborating it in different directions. But a close tie now between what I'm saying and those reading elements, particularly under Section 3 assignment sheet. And let me mention the one other person that may be of interest in eventual help to some of you that I'm also making use of, and that's a scholar, F.W. Grossheide, who was a teacher of Dr. Stonehouse at the Free University of Amsterdam, and who then is working also along the same lines as Ritterboss, and I believe he'd also been a teacher of Ritterboss.
Yeah.
And his work then is a work on canonicity, which is only available in Dutch, but which I found very helpful for the work that we're doing here. Yes, go ahead.
Just kind of off the cuff, but I just wonder if you have put a bug in the ear of CNR about getting Ritterboss's work republished.
I'm in the midst of continuing to put that bug there, yes. Now, you can see then that in a first main section, subsection here, we want to raise the question of criterion of canonicity. Criteria of canonicity. The possibility of such criteria. And here, especially for what I'm going to say in this section, I'm very much dependent on Grossheide's, to my mind, very helpful discussion. You see, it might appear that a proper approach now in the whole to the whole issue that we've been raising, a solution to the question that we've posed, it might seem that the way to go is in the direction of establishing or distinguishing certain criteria or marks of canonicity, or to say it more classically with the church, certain nota, or really nota in the plural. That is, and we must keep clear now, I'm going to try to avoid some confusion that seems often to come up here. But I'm using, as I think you'll see as we go along, I'm using the notion of criterion in a very specific way. I hope that'll become clear. It might seem, then, we're saying, that we ought to go in the way of trying to isolate a particular index, a criterion or index, so that by its possession, the canonicity of a particular book would be demonstrated, or alternatively, by the lack of that mark or index or criterion, by the lack of it, the non-canonical status of a book would be demonstrated. Now, I think you can see immediately then that the whole enterprise solution lies in the ability to be able to isolate and then validly demonstrate that a given factor X is a criterion or mark of canonicity. The whole effort here, the whole trick, so to speak, lies in our ability to be able to circumscribe, to isolate, and to demonstrate that a given factor is an index or mark of canonicity. And now, the thesis that I want to proceed here to consider with you with reference to this whole question of criterion of canonicity is this: that in its history, the church has, in fact, not been able to establish criteria of canonicity. And then further, I want us to consider that with specific reference to our own concrete situation, where we are as church today, the church cannot and really ought not to to be seeking to establish criteria of canonicity. So our discussion in reflecting on this thesis and establishing it will go along, we can say, more material lines and more formal lines. We want to show, first of all, materially, that in fact, as the historical state of affairs, the Church has not been able to establish a criteria of canonicity. And then more formally, we want to see that the Church cannot and ought not really to seek that. And remember now, particularly with reference to our own situation, the criterion, the notion of criterion must be understood in the very circumscribed sense of that which is a characteristic of these 27 books and these alone. What is demonstrated to be a mark of just these 27, because the issue here is with reference to the closed or completed character of this 27-book collection. Now, with reference to our thesis, we want, then, first of all, along material historical grounds, looking at the history of the Church, I want us to appreciate that all attempts to establish criterion, have failed. The first proposal, by far the most frequently, the factor most frequently employed as criterion is that of apostolicity. Apostolicity in the sense of apostolic authorship. Now again, before I go any further here, try to obviate misunderstanding. And what I'm about to say here, I am not at all wanting to deny a very definite connection between apostolicity and canonicity. Look on your outline sheet if it's available. You'll see that section C, a little bit later on here, section C is concerned to address just that very important connection, important relationship between apostolicity and canonicity. And I'm not wanting here to be denying that close connection, but the issue here is now is the particular issue of apostolicity or apostolic authorship as a criterion of canonicity. And its failure, in the sense stipulated, criterion as a mark, in the sense of a mark of these 27 and just these alone, that breaks down in the case of the following: Mark, Luke, Acts, Hebrews, Jude, and probably James. Mark, Luke, Acts, Hebrews, Jude, James are not of apostolic authorship. Now this is a rough... Let me go on here. I can appreciate all kinds of questions that are come on, and it will, I think, be well for me to maybe have... I won't insist on being able to say everything I want to say, but at least I'll try to break things up into what, in my mind, are reasonable units, logical breaking points. There has been an effort, then, to respond to this rather obvious observation by then redefining the notion of apostolicity in the sense of that which is close to the circle of apostles. Apostolicity in the sense of that which belongs to an apostolic environment. Now again, that of course, would be true that the New Testament books are all to be seen within an apostolic environment. But that way now of redefining apostolicity as a criterion, I think, is to weaken it, and to weaken it fatally with reference to the demands of criterion. Because there are a number of other writings not included in the 27-book collection that could be seen as having meeting the stipulation of apostolic environment. Beyond that, before I mention some specific examples, there is also the case of the book of Hebrews, about which it's very difficult to draw any firm picture one way or the other as to its precise origin, provenance, authorship, and even the context out of which it comes is difficult to identify. And particularly in a statement like 2:3, the writer seems to be putting himself at some distance from the original apostolic circle. But then also to consider here is the fact that in 1 Corinthians 5:9, Paul makes mention of a previous letter to the Corinthian congregation, a letter prior to 1 Corinthians, not now extant to us, and a letter which he refers to in a way, maybe we should take just a second to look at that, 1 Corinthians 5:9, I wrote to you in the letter not to associate with the sexually immoral. And you see that he, as he is now writing authoritatively in 1 Corinthians on this issue to the Corinthian congregation, he is appealing to a previous equally authoritative letter addressed to the Corinthian congregation. This previous letter is being viewed by him as being on a par with 1 Corinthians. Also is the fact that in Colossians 4:16, Paul makes reference there to a letter of his to the Laodiceans. Which again is on a par, which can be seen there to be on a par with the Colossian letter, inasmuch as Paul enjoins that there be an interchange of these letters, the Colossian epistle and the Laodicean epistle. Also, there may be reference to a previous letter to the Philippian congregation in Philippians 3:1. That is perhaps not so clear, although it's interesting that that someone like Polycarp, in his letter to the Philippians, remember Polycarp was one of the post-apostolic fathers that we were mentioning yesterday, early second century, he sees or makes reference to several letters, more than one letter of Paul to the Philippians. So along these lines, apostolicity, in the strict sense of the apostolic authorship, and apostolicity then as meeting the demands of criterion in the sense of the mark of these 27 and these alone, is seen to come short. A second factor that has been proposed is that of antiquity. The factor of antiquity, that is, what's old, oldest. And really, I think that can be seen as a variation on the first, apostolicity, an effort to rehabilitate or maintain that from another angle. But again, the problems are obvious. There is the previous letter, the letter previous to 1 Corinthians 5:9, which is not part of the canon, as well as other letters of Paul and Peter, which, if we take a relatively late date for Revelation, say, are written before Revelation, Book of Hebrews, whatever. But antiquity, that these are the 27 oldest, has its problems. A third is the factor of public, well, to put it the way Zahn does, public lection, that is, reading. And in view of the background of the synagogue service, that for which there's some continuity with Christian worship, this is certainly a strong indicator of what was thought to be canonical. Those documents which were first used then for public worship. But here then we have to consider the fact that the shepherd and the Didache, which early on were used in public worship, at least to some degree, eventually pass out of the picture. While on the other side, you take something like 2 Peter or 2 and 3 John, we have no evidence of their use in public worship. A fourth factor, then, is a factor of inspiration. Inspiration as criterion of canonicity. This is a position, then, that is argued, for instance, or maintained by Professor Harris from Covenant, Professor Dr. Laird Harris from Covenant Seminary, in a small book, Can I Trust My Bible? Page 77. And in the optional item that I gave you on your reading sheet, Inspiration and Canonicity of the Bible, beginning at page 200. It's at the beginning of that section. Now again, obvious, as with apostolicity, an obvious connection between inspiration and canonicity. And my remarks here are, the issue is not to to call that into question. But I think we have to consider this, that even inspiration, although necessary to canonicity, does not coincide with it. Inspiration does not coincide with canonicity. To put it another way, we're making the observation here, that inspiration is a necessary but not a sufficient condition of canonicity. Inspiration is a necessary but not a sufficient condition. Why do I say that? Because, again, I think we have to consider here the letter of 1 Corinthians 5, the previous letter mentioned in 1 Corinthians 5:9. The whole way in which that letter is referred to there, I think, brings us to consider that as it bears the same authority, so it was written with the same inspiration. It is has its origin in the same inspiration that 1 Corinthians does. And again, the interchange of the Laodicean letter with the Colossian letter put on a par in terms of interchange would, I think, suggest the same consideration. And that we don't want to go around here now multiplying unnecessarily letters of Paul, say, that are not at our disposal, not in the canon. But I think that these verses do bring us to consider, they do indicate that Paul wrote letters to churches. He wrote letters in his inspired apostolic capacity, letters which are not in the canon. Fifth, is a criterion or a criterion effort of a somewhat different character. These marks are all, we can say, formal sorts of characteristics. Apostolos, the antiquity, lexing, and inspiration. As a fifth, we may mention a content criterion. Specifically, if we want to put a label on it, a Christocentricity. Christocentricity, a Christocentric character. And again, the issue is not that there is a very integral connection between the Scriptures and Christ, or that we should even hesitate to affirm, as I will want to develop with you elsewhere, that Christ is the center of the Scriptures. That's not the issue. The issue here now is the Christocentric factor as a content factor functioning as a criterion of canonicity. We can say that this position has been introduced classically in the Reformation context by Martin Luther in his assertion that what is canonical, what is Scripture, is vos Christum private. What drives Christ? What inculcates Christ? What pushes Christ home to us? We can begin to see the problem with such a notion functioning as criterion of canonicity when we see how it in fact worked out in the case of Luther. The Vos Christum private principle led Luther then to relegate the following books to a less than full canonical status, to a so-called deuterocanonical position. Specifically, Hebrews, James, Jude, and Revelation. These books, according to Luther, with his forceful grasp of the doctrine of justification by faith alone, these books were felt to be not to measure up, were felt to be wanting. And Luther's, Dr. Stonehouse, in the article I assigned you, will discuss this whole question further, and I think bring helpful analysis both of Luther's position and criticism of it. But we can see then in Luther's case, the obvious danger, the obvious flaw that has become apparent again and again as others subsequent to Luther have sought to employ this criterion. Canon now becomes dependent on the judgment of the individual interpreter. Canon becomes subject to the judgment of the individual interpreter. It becomes then again and again, what drives Christ home to me? That serves to define canon. And we can say then that in a much modified way, this
conception is the criterion of canonicity, if we can still use the word canonicity. This is the criterion of canonicity that functions in much modern theology, much contemporary critical theology. It gives rise to the need to establish, as it is put now in the terms of those involved in this enterprise itself, it gives rise to the need to identify the canon within the canon. Such an approach brings, as is amply demonstrated, I'm saying, in the contemporary situation, brings the need to identify the canon within the canon. That is, what is affirmed to be normative within canon in that sense, what is affirmed to be normative within canon in the sense of the 27-book collection. But what this does, inevitably, you can appreciate then, is really to destroy one canon and create another. And what is further very evident along this line and amply demonstrated in contemporary development, on this approach, it's not really that a distinct new canon on which all are agreed emerges, but the boundaries of canon, if we can still properly use that word now, the boundaries of this new canon are not fixed. They can change in principle as often as the person employing the principle changes or changes his mind with reference to what drives Christ. In short, this content criterion of Christocentricity gives rise to what we could tag as an activistic view of canon, a constantly shifting definition of canon. And in the modern context, that is totally understandable because this is a conception of canon which is just as activistic as the underlying view of Revelation is activistic. Involved here, in the contemporary developments at least, is very much the whole notion of the whole insistence on the autonomy of faith, the autonomy of faith. Where I find Christ at this moment, where I find Christ at this moment is canonical. Along these lines, then, we are affirming that the effort to establish criteria of canonicity down through the history of the church has, in fact, not succeeded. Question? Yes, that's, from my point of view, that's a very good and pointed observation, and it's the point that I will be going on to develop just presently. Yes. I said, yes, it's not sufficient. No, I'm saying that apostolicity is not a criterion in the sense of the mark of these 27 and these alone. Because that's always the sense in which I'm using the word criterion here. Not that the books aren't all apostolic in a certain broadened sense. But in fact, all of the books are not of apostolic authorship. And I think that's really... really the question if they did argue just that way. But, again, I think you want to keep you want to keep distinct the question of what is happening within the life of the church in the first four centuries in the history that we're looking for. That is a more open-ended situation. And then the issue of criterion with reference to our vantage point or our place in church history now, where it becomes a question with reference to what has functioned down through the centuries of the church's life as an entity in our effort now, or the effort of earlier generations, to validate just those 27 and they alone. And that's, I think, where the problems come up. Maybe I haven't fully appreciated yet. No, I wouldn't want to necessarily say that. That would be pushing it a little too far, or definitely too far. I'm simply saying in the specific case, it seems to me, of the previous letter of 1 Corinthians 5, that he is giving that letter the same and equal status so far as authority in the life of the church is concerned. He says, I wrote to you before, and now I'm writing to you again. And so I think in this specific instance, I feel it's at least highly probable, best to draw the conclusion that previous document as being of equal authority is inspired. And similarly, the way in which the injunction of the interchange of letters between Laodicea and Colossae is enjoined. This is not to establish some abstract, inspired character of all apostles, because you have the reality of the apostolic conflict between Peter and Paul in Galatia to consider. Okay, we're not going to go any further today. We have a minute. If there's still a question, we can pick it up here. Okay, you're raising now a couple questions that I want to try to take up in order as we move along. Obviously, the whole question of providence and how legitimate and in what ways we appeal to providence in this whole question is a very important one, and I'll be getting at that.